This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Tuesday. Matt, Brett. We're mailing it in, man. We're going to mail it on in. We don't have to work today. We got guests ahoy.
Guests ahoy.
Guests ahoy. Coming up first, I should mention, is going to be our Democrat of the day. That would be the lovely and talented, and I'm sure he likes me calling him lovely and talented, the lovely and talented Senator John Hoffman from Senate District 36 of the North Side. I've already interviewed pretty much every House rep and senator from the South Side candidate here. I need to go northbound. So Hoffman's going to join us. Friend of the station, friend of the show. He's been at the Blue State Ball a few times, so it's always nice to have him on by. We'll talk about what he has been up to with last year and stuff like that. That comes up here at 4:35. You, of course, have got your usual shindig, happy time, guest ahoy on Tuesday. Who are we chatting with today?
Yeah, Peter Callahan, MinnPost, talking obviously the state legislature, but also caucuses tonight, which are kind of easy to forget about. I forgot about them until like a week ago that they happen this year. It's a midterm election.
Yep, I'm registered for our caucus tonight. It's remote, so I don't know, and I also got to get some stuff done. I don't know if I'll be able to get to it. But I'm looking forward to that, and we'll look forward to talking to him. And then we'll talk caucuses as well with Hoffman. I'll mention that because we'll find out what they're doing up in 36 because it depends on the district. Jack Rice, the immortal Jack Rice, and soon to be etched into the I think he's going to be his statue is going to replace the Columbus one. I'm not mistaken about the state capitol.
I'm sure he signed off on that one.
I'm sure. Wait a minute, Jack. You would have loved that. I'll be out there. I'll send invites for the dedication ceremony. Could we do that? I mean, could we get Jack Rice as the statue that replaced? I like that idea. Jack is going to join us. We'll talk the trial because let's face it, and this is something we talked about this with the Chauvin trial. I brought this up yesterday. If you throw the Minneapolis Police Department under the bus, as you probably should, you might actually have a pretty good defense. Because in the case of the three cops that are on trial right now, frankly, it sounds much more like this is a Minneapolis Police Department horrific training issue. And at some point this hour, I'm going to try to get to the Unicorn Riot story. I don't know if you've seen this, but they got one of the training manuals.
Oh, boy.
Oh, my God. So I finally finished watching every Marvel movie. In order. I did this when I had the hip replacement surgery.
No kidding. Is this 2022 movies included as well?
Yeah, I finally got the Spider-Man No Way Home. That's it. So I'm caught up completely. Shang-Chi, Eternals, all of them. Watched them in order too, which was not easy. But I did, it got them all done. The Incredible Hulk is hard to find. The original, the one with Edward Norton, because that's part of canon. That's I believe that was the second movie that came out or the first
one?
I think it was the second, first or second. Anyway, but needless to say, I watched them all. I have come up with my personal favorites, and I'm actually doing a ranking on the Progressive Citizen X blog, and I'm going to put this out, of my personal favorites of the movie. And take a guess at what my number one movie is.
You said it yesterday. I know already.
Which one?
Ragnarok.
Yeah, of course it's Ragnarok. And for God's sake, Goldblum. Goldblum is brilliant in that. Just the whole thing is just perfect. And I can't wait for Love and Thunder. That looks amazing, too. Anything I've seen from that. I just love that movie. I have to admit, I'm also I'm a big fan of Captain America, the Winter Soldier. That one where he finally meets Bucky again. And because it comes off almost like a spy thriller. And very well done as of that, and the introduction of the Falcon, and I mean, kind of the interplay between Captain America and Black Widow. That was a fun movie, a very good movie. Take a guess at what the worst one is.
Yeah, I was actually gonna at least ask for your bottom five or worst one.
Oh, I won't say a bottom five. Well, I can tell you, I think the bottom two. I think
three,
it's first of all, I mean, the one which, as I watched these back. I could not believe this was as bad as it was, because comparatively, especially to the formulaic nature of how they make these movies now, this movie's a mess. Thor: The Dark World. And so the best movie on the list is the third Thor film. The worst movie is the second Thor film. That movie was just god awful.
God, I even forgot about that movie, to be honest.
Dark elves and stuff like this, and it has some pretty big continuity issues. It's just – it's not a – even Loki is not entertaining in that film. It really is a bad film. It constantly gets referenced in the within the movies, though. They keep kind of referencing back to that. I mean, I think about the only thing that came out of that movie that played on it was that was the Reality Stone. That's one of Thanos' stones came out of that one. But that was bad. That's almost almost as bad as Iron Man 2, which is just, yeah. You know, the mistake you can't make, and this is, I think, and both those movies came on out relatively soon or near each other. The Iron Man 2, the mistake you make with Iron Man 2 is that you can't just go take a 3 or 4 pages from beloved storylines and then just jam them together with 3 or 4 pages from other beloved storylines and think it's going to work. And that's the part of the problem. I mean, one of the great comic book series with Iron Man was Tony Stark when he was an alcoholic. I mean, that was a really stark reality based. I mean, Marvel does this all the time too. They've, you know, the Luke Cage series and some of the other series they've done. They've been very based in reality of the real world that they are living in, and a very tough series and a very, you know, sobering series. And you just can't take 3 pages out of that series and think you can, oh, yeah, this will work. I'll take these parts and we'll go from there. No, you can't do that. So I will post that whole list up. And I'm sure no one's going to disagree with me.
You could drag it out. You could do like your countdown from bottom up, one each day.
Oh, gosh. Years ago, I did. No, I'm not going to do that. I have a hard enough time publishing on blog, Blogspot or whatever thing I'm in, Blogster or whatever it is. A few years ago, I ranked my favorite doctors from Doctor Who. The good thing is that pretty much I think everyone agrees that Thor: The Dark World is just atrocious. So I don't think anyone's going to come back saying that's my favorite one. Really? That's your favorite? Wow. Have you seen the other ones? Because they're good. They're a lot better. But when I did that, oh, my God, did I get grief from Doctor Who. When Doctor Who fan gets upset, prepare for a strongly worded 5 to 6 page response. And it's just, let me tell you, first of all, why I disagree with you. Oh, good.
Is this your first time watching Doctor Who, Matt?
Matt.
A real fan wouldn't think the way you do. Yeah.
And
where that's going.
And nothing is better than being that rock skimming across that nerd pond. I mean, really, it's just, mwah. All right. Things I've got to get to. Let's start off right now with the Minnesota coronavirus update. Tuesday's COVID-19 update from the Minnesota Department of Health includes 21,360 newly reported cases, 46 newly reported deaths. The state's COVID-19 death toll is now 11,457. Today's update includes the data that was reported in the 72-hour period ending at 4 a.m. on Monday, January 31st. That's why we're in the 20,000s. It's a 3-day total. But for the first time in a while, I mean, that's a little more than 7,000 cases per day. That's actually down. Here's where we're kind of, do I dare say a flicker of hope? Do I dare say it? Minnesota's test positivity rate on a 7-day rolling average was 21%. That is down pretty dramatically from when I believe it was 22.3 yesterday. Now, 21% is still god awful. That's basically 1 out of every 5 tests is coming back positive. But it wasn't the near 24% we had a few weeks ago. It's coming back down. Anything over 10% puts Minnesota in the high-risk threshold community transmission of the coronavirus. Through January 31st, the number of people with COVID hospitalized in Minnesota was 1,370. Another positive decrease because it was 1,455. So that is a good 85 patients less in hospitals. And once again, I think we need to say this, and we need to say this with regularity. Nurses, doctors, anyone working in the hospital, you're angels. You're absolute angels. You deserve bonuses. You deserve pay raises. You deserve a long vacation. You all deserve it. You have been wonderful. Thank you. I am not there is just too many people that demand people get on the front lines and do not have the decency to thank the people afterwards. I am going to make sure for the rest of my life I salute the medical professionals who went out there and did their best to try to save as many patients as they could, even in the face of blinding ignorance and stupidity. Just you kept it there. You are far more patient than I would have ever been, hands down. Hands down. We're starting to get there. At least we're not at the point where there's no beds in most hospitals. I mean, we're at the point now where it does seem to be opening things up. Of those hospitalized, 192 are in intensive care. That's down from 208. Once again, I do not want to downplay the serious nature of the 192. I also do not want to downplay the tragic deaths of 46. These things need to be remembered. These need to be acknowledged. But at the same time, these numbers are down, and that's the direction we want them to go. 11,078 non-ICU care. That is down from 1,247. So 47 plus 22 is 69. 69 less in non-ICU care. That's good. ICU COVID admissions rose 374 on December 16th. It's been falling ever since. The 192 current ICU patients is actually the fewest in Minnesota since there was 190 on September 12th. And by the way, any of you anti-mask, anti-vax idiots saying, see, we got through this. We had to crack a few eggs, but we got through this. Shut up. Your eggs are human lives, you asses. Dear Lord. I've heard that a little. See, it's getting better. We didn't need to wear masks. What are you talking about? The reason it was so bad was because so many of you clowns were not wearing masks. The reason why this was so bad is there were so many clowns that weren't vaccinated. It's your fault this got this bad. So don't try to take some sort of credit or victory lap afterwards after we're starting to get this under control. Just fools. The latest hospital capacity data shows there are 47 staffed ICU beds available in the entire state. There are 17 pediatric ICU beds. So there's at least we can deal with heart attacks, strokes, and car crashes. Thank you. Thank you very much for the small things. Once again, doctors, nurses, absolute freaking angels. You're absolute angels. And I don't care. I mean, I know there's a lot of doctors out there, especially doctors who do not agree with my politics. I understand that. I still think you're magnificent. You're doing God's work out there, and bless you on that. As of January 30th, the state reported that 3,843,231 people have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. 3,598,752 people have completed the vaccine series. The state has administered 2,043,269 third dose booster shots. The total number of cases in the state of Minnesota, not eggs, human beings who got sick, 1,343,090, which now we are kind of getting close to, yeah, we're getting close to a quarter of the state. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Please, now, get vaccinated. Get vaccinated. Wear a mask. And, yeah, you need to wear a mask for a few more weeks, at least. At least. My recommendation would probably be to Easter. At least. But for the record, let's make sure we run through this. I do not want you dead. I do not want you sick. I do not want you bankrupt. And as we decided to add yesterday, I don't want you having illness for the next year, 2 years, 5 years. This long COVID is not a joke. I heard from actually some listeners who have family members who have had long COVID. It is not a joke. I don't know. I mean, we might end up having to create a new level of a category of disability here because people can't get back to work. They're technically, you know, there is technically a disability here because of this disease that is long term. But don't worry. I'm sure Republicans will fight that. Don't worry. Especially all your Republicans out there that got long COVID. Don't worry. As the Democrats try to get your condition recognized and get you additional assistance or at least clarification within health insurance policies so that you actually get paid and you have, you know, long-term care insurance and stuff like that, don't worry. The Republicans will try to stop us from doing all that good stuff. See? Compromise. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Let's take a break. Come on back. Got other stories I got to get to before our first guest, Senator John Hoffman, joins us here in just a few minutes. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.
I can't shut off this stereo. I'm all right. Nobody but about me. Why you got to give me a fight? Can't you just let it be?
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Once again, Democrat of the day is going to be Senator John Hoffman about 10 minutes from right now. Just an absolute tragic story here occurring in Richfield today. One student dead, another remains in critical condition after a shooting at the South Education Center Academy in Richfield. Richfield Police Chief Jay Henthorne said the two victims were shot around 12:07 p.m., while on the sidewalk outside the school located at 7400 block of Penn Avenue South, both students were taken to Hennepin County Medical Center. One later died. The other is in a critical condition, Henthorne said, calling it a tragic day for the city of Richfield. The suspects fled the scene immediately. The chief said, we have not been found. Anyone who has information on the shooting is being urged to call the tip line, which is 1-800-CALL-FBI, 1-800-CALL-FBI. There is really no words to describe the bravery exhibited by our staff and local authorities today, said Superintendent Sandra Lewandowski, who no one should ever have to respond to a tragedy like this. South Education Center Academy went into a lockdown. Henthorne said other area schools were also placed into lockdown as a precaution. As of 2:40, those lockdowns were being lifted. Students have not yet been publicly identified, and neither Henthorne or Lewandowski took questions from reporters. Another senseless gun violence in involving students in a school. Now, different, it is a different story than when a student brings a gun into a school and starts shooting. 7400 block of Penn Avenue. I've been over that, so I'm going to. That's that. Not mistaken, isn't that just north of 494 on Penn? I think that's just north of 494 on Penn. Yeah, 494 is like 76. So I think that is – and matter of fact, if I'm, here's the thing which I think is pretty upsetting if this is the same school. My kid actually had some classes there, some summer camp classes a few years ago at this school. Lovely school facility. Absolutely a lovely school facility. I think they did court thing there, that was part of it, and so we were there with a bunch of students. I think when my son Charlie was a juror for that student youth court, youth court situation that they did. A nice school, I believe it is also. The South Education Center Academy is a charter school. I do believe. I don't know how much interaction it has with the Richfield public school system. But a charter school down there. But this is it happened at the school on the sidewalk outside the school. Now, there's also – this is another issue. If this is the same school, and I believe it is, there is a sidewalk that's out on Penn. So this would then technically be kind of a drive-by shooting. But there's also a sidewalk that runs – I mean the school is offset from the street. It's back from the street a little bit. So did the gunman drive their vehicle into the parking lot, gun the kids down, and then turn around and come back out? Obviously more details on this story will come to light on this. This is just, and get ready for the thoughts and prayers. We could stop this tomorrow. We just decided not to. There is nothing about our gun laws in this country that encourage the well-regulated militia part of the Second Amendment. We many states don't require training. Many states just require you to fill out a form to get a carry and conceal license. Most people that carry a gun, they don't know what they're doing. And in the offshoot of that is that there are people out there, and let's just be honest about it, white people who are out there buying tons of guns out in the white parts of these states and taking them into the inner city and selling them on the streets. And that's how these guns get out there. I know that white America likes to think to themselves like, no, these guys came out and they busted into the house and they took the guns. No. There are people out there right now who are buying up guns, taking them into the city, marking them up and selling them on the streets. Because it's a carnival. There is no accountability. There is none of this. For God's sakes, you could find one of these guys who's out buying guns in rural Minnesota or rural Wisconsin and bringing them into the city and selling them in the streets, and there'll be a Republican out there defending him, saying all he was trying to do was make sure people are participating in the Second Amendment. I don't necessarily agree with the illegal selling, but, you know, I don't think we should. I think that we give them a stern warning and tell them not to do it again. Uh-huh. The guns suck. I don't care if they're in white Minnesota or black Minnesota. Guns suck. I have told you my position many times. I will tell you it again. Hunting weapons, no one is pulling off mass shootings with a hunting weapon, an actual hunting weapon. A shotgun or a hunting rifle for deer or moose. No. That's rare if it does happen. I personally would never carry one in my life. I don't really have a problem with a personal defense pistol. I don't. What I've always said I have a problem with are the weapons that when someone sat down and grabbed graph paper and a pencil to start designing said weapon, they were designing it with one purpose: to kill as many human beings as fast and as quickly as possible. You can try to candy coat it as, well, I used it for deer hunting. Okay, but it was designed to kill human beings, as many of them as possible, as quickly as possible. They're lethal, they are deadly, and we have more people insisting that we can't do anything about this. That this loss, this tragedy, is just part of life now in America. No, it's only been part of life for the last about 40 years. Don't get me wrong, there were shootings and stuff before. It was. But not on the epidemic level that we're at today. And the only reason we are at this level today is that the Republicans have done everything in their power to give as many guns as possible. Remember the guy that shot up the hospital in Buffalo? Remember that guy? The police even were flabbergasted. I was like, the guy should not have a gun, but there is no way on the planet I can take one away from him, because the second I do, some Republican is going to come out there and say, how dare you? Because this is the game they play. They demand the man is armed, and when that man shoots up the hospital, then they ask the questions like, he probably shouldn't have had a gun. Well, then what law do we have that allows us to strip the man of the gun prior to the shooting? You don't want to pass that law. As a matter of fact, you've done everything to make sure that no law gets passed when someone who is clearly mentally compromised has a gun. Nope. Heck, you got even states where you can't, even a gun confiscated in a crime cannot be melted down, cannot be destroyed, has to be saved because isn't somebody thinking about the guns? Today, there are two crushed families. Two families who will never be the same. A split second of action. They could have bats, they could have axes, they could have blood pipes, they could have knives, they wouldn't have done this. They could have a bow and arrows, and we're gonna be Hawkeye, for God's sakes. This murder is courtesy of guns. And until we actually have intelligent leaders who are willing to go on out there and say enough is enough, just get more ready for more of it. While the people who love the guns quietly clap in the background. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Let's take a break. When we come on back, John Hoffman, Senator John Hoffman, is Democrat of the day, District 36. We'll talk to him in a second. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Democrat of the day, we head to the north side of the metro area, Senate District 36, Senator John Hoffman, longtime friend of the radio station, longtime friend of the show. He is kind enough to join us today to talk about the Democrat of the day, as well as all the things that he's up to. Senator, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Hey, it's February 1st, man, and to be the Democrat of the day on the first day of February is absolutely awesome and cool. How are you?
I'm doing well. How in the heck is your district getting all the cool restaurants now?
we got some of the coolest. We still have. I mean, you look at some of the coolest restaurants that you're going to have in the North Metro. If you want truly classic Italian, that is absolutely beyond anybody's scope of imagination, right? At Buenos Aires in Champlin has been there for 20-some years. Champlin. I'm not doing a payola, by the way. I pay for everything I do when I go to eat there. So, you can't get the radio in trouble there on that one. But absolutely, it is the place. It's kind of like popping left and right here, you know?
Well,
We got it here. So
I think with 610 being built now and going across, which is just such a nice addition up there. But you got 610 up there. And now it's like all of a sudden it's like, wait a second, there's a whole bunch of people up here and everyone's coming. I mean, it is a great district to move into. Brooklyn Park, Champlin, and Coon Rapids, right?
That is correct. You got it right. Senate District 36, it's kind of been that the triadic thing for 40-some years because of the Mississippi River. You know, it goes back to when it was like District 49 and then 47, which was, before 47, it was Gene Merriam, who is still around, and then Leo Foley was the senator here when it was District 47, and it was basically the three communities, and then they've had one thing in common, is that Mississippi River, and of course, you know, Darby Nelson, who for years was a state rep up here, mm-hmm. and you know, he just passed away. I mean, the reason we have clean water in Minnesota, because this professor from the PhD in physiobiologic something, it was just just enormous. He taught me more in the few years that I knew him about clean water than anybody has ever taught in my history. I mean, it's just absolutely, and he's a missed treasure for the state of Minnesota, and because of the LCCMR, because we, you know, when I did the Clean Water Accountability Act in 2014, it was at the bequest of Darby. I mean, he really said, look, we got to have one of the agencies got to be able to be that final authority in making sure that we have clean water from non-point source pollution. And we made it happen. And so, you know, hats off to him. He's a treasured soul for the state of Minnesota, and he's a loss this year. So, that is something that I don't think any of us will ever realize, just, you know, what he meant to our district and what he meant to the state of Minnesota for clean water. So.
And the legacy goes on well beyond his political service and helping out and still helping to craft legislation. Again, that's kind of, you know, you and him share that quality. And this is one of the things I like about you, Senator, is that you care about the constituents. You care about your district. You care about Minnesota. And you if you're only in there to push an agenda or do the bidding of a handful of bankrollers of your campaign, you're not going to do good for the constituents. You're there for the people, and that's a true sign. That's one of the reasons I'm a big fan of yours as well.
Well, thanks, Matt. And you know, this last session, for example, you know, 94% of all my bills were bipartisan. You know, people said, really? That still happens? I'm like, well, yeah. You know, if you believe in common good and you believe in common ground, you know, it's what I said in 2012 and in 2020. And you know, people up here just said, can you just set aside the bickering and finger pointing, and can you absolutely work together to get things done? And then it dawned on me, there was a gentleman, Jim Ramstead, for years, who representative, you know, our congressional district, right? Which now Dean Phillips has, right? And
yeah.
Dean is absolutely the best of the best when it comes to that. But Jim Ramstead used to say, put your partisan politics out in the hallway. You know, if we're talking about education or health and human services, we got to look at being pragmatic and common sense. And it dawned on me. I thought, wow, what a concept that was. And then it really hit me that he meant what he said when he always started off his town halls talking about Paul Wellstone and how they used to go do dinner together, how they worked together. The whole parody, mental health parody stuff was done because of Paul Wellstone and Jim Ramstad. It's like, imagine that. Two guys that if you sat down on the political spectrum and said, where do you exist? You know, Rammer's going to be in the middle and Wellstone was going to be a little bit to the left of that. But yet, you know what? Man, did they find common ground, man. And I think it still can be done. If you look at your region, if you look at your constituency, if you look at what people really want, they don't care if you're Republican or Democrat. Mm-hmm. Just go get it done. Roll up your sleeves and work.
You know, I want to bring that up, though, because, I mean, last session here, as we go through some of this stuff, I mean, you had the Republicans in the Senate turn down the amendment to basically say, hey, white supremacists can't be cops in Minnesota. There are some people that would say, well, that's a pretty good no-brainer. You know, it's like members of extremist groups probably shouldn't be police officers. But yet that was kind of pushed aside. What do you see as the key to convince Republicans that, you know, hey, this is a no-brainer, clean water, let's say. I mean, obviously clean water is a good idea. How do you convey that when you go out there and say, you know, I've got a bunch of Democrats with me, the DFLers are on my side, how about we get you on our side as well? How are you able to pull that off?
Well, you got to look at it's the 80-20 rule, right? If just because you disagree with me 20% of the time and you agree with me 80% of the time, it doesn't make you my enemy, Matt. I mean, you got to depersonalize everything. It's got to get to the focus at hand. And I think that's the only way you get to it. And I'll give you a couple of examples. 2 years ago, Senator Abler from Anoka, right, a Republican, and myself, we were fighting to try to keep some of our adult day centers and home and community-based services providers afloat during this pandemic because all of a sudden, you know, they shut their doors. And it's like, well, wait a minute. We still have to pay this. We still have to pay that. How are we going to be able to do this? And the Fed said, well, if you do some flexible options, you can sure keep that money and pay it, right? And it was like brick wall after brick wall after brick wall. And I finally, the libertarian in the Republican Party, right, a senator, a libertarian, he said to me as I was talking to him about just how frustrating, he said, you know what? This is what government's about. He said, I want to get involved. Oh, my God, Matt, you don't think at that point all of a sudden I had an ally. I'm probably not going to agree with him on, you know, 80% of his stuff. But the fact is, in this case, he was a huge ally. And people on my side of the aisle were saying, wow, he just signed on to one of your bills. You're actually working with him. And I said, yeah. And they go, wow, how'd you do that? I said, oh, by the way, he still hates government. But yeah, in this case, this is what he said government's for. And so if people can set aside some of that partisan crap that's out there, Matt. And I mean it not in the sense that there's partisan stuff, because you and I will sit here and we'll have a conversation about there are some things that the Republicans will do. You just go, oh, my God, did you guys really say that or do that? It's like, come on. On the same side, there's some things some of our Democrat colleagues will say or do. And you go, did you really say that or do that? But I can't personalize it. It's not about me, right, Matt? Mm-hmm. It's about what I'm here to do, which is to do the quest of the people that we're here to serve. And so when we're talking about good schools, safe neighborhoods, quality roads, clean water, compassionate care for our elderly and people with disabilities, fair tax policy, good paying jobs, aren't those values that we all care about? Aren't those values that we could all say, yeah, I love it, right? Mm-hmm. We all want clean water. You brought that up, right? Yeah. We all want clean water, right? I want to fish in it. I want to swim in it. I want to run my boat in it. I'm going to move some product up and down it. But you know what? I want clean water. I want to use that water to grow plants. Farmers want clean water. Sometimes we just got to educate people about what does that mean? You know, why aren't we doing more buffer laws? Why aren't we doing more stuff? Because if the outcome is clean water, we can all agree that's a value that we want. Same thing with roads, right? It's just how you get there is really going to be the debate on how it, right? Mm-hmm. And the joke is sometimes I absolutely, back in 2013, Governor Dayton, when he said, you know what? I want to raise my taxes. I want to get some fairness in tax. I want to get some tax fairness here, fair tax policy, right? And he put that extra layer in, and I'm not a tax person, but I just remember we raised taxes on the top 1%, which was enough money to be able to pay back the schools. Because remember,
yeah,
prior to that, the previous administration borrowed $2.6 billion from our school district.
Oh, so Pirate Palenti. I remember Pirate Palenti raiding the school district budgets. Yeah, I remember that.
And then he goes, well, I balanced the budget. No, you didn't. You balanced it on the backs of the third generation of kids that are going to be coming through that you promised to pay, right?
Yeah.
Well, I absolutely agree with Mark Dayton, you know, a fair tax policy. And you know, the joke is among, you know, some of the colleagues on the other side of the aisle, they go, well, just ask Hoffman, you know, his response is to raise taxes in the top 1%. And I will sit there and tell them, absolutely, I don't think the rich pay a fair share of their taxes. Yeah, do they pay more taxes? They sure do. But when you look at it, is it a fair tax policy? That's a question on the table. And so I'll always say I don't think they do. No. So,
outstate districts, where does most of your tax dollars come back into your district from? Oh, that's right. Never mind.
Yeah. Carrie Dietzick one time. I love her, right? She and Ann Rested, when we were in the majority, and I'll never forget, she drew a picture of the state of Minnesota on this board, and then she circled Hennepin County, and then she started running all these dollar bills out of Hennepin County. And she goes, you know what that is, Hoffman? That's most of the tax dollars coming from this county are going out to help offset, you know, other counties. And I, you know, I sat there and I kind of smiled, but what she said was true. It's exactly to your point, right?
Yeah. No. Nice. Yeah. Well, it is. You and I could just sit and chat all day. I love having you on. By the way, we should do that. We'll have a show where you just, we're not going to talk politics. You and I will just talk about anything we want to talk about. I'm going to have you back for that for sure. But I want to get into.
Just let it fly. Just go.
we'll have the dump button ready to go. So coming up this session, as you look at the new session, you're the ranking minority member on the Human Services Reform, Finance and Policy Committee. You're also on aging and long-term care, as well as technology and reform. What are some of the issues that you're looking to try to champion coming up in this next session, especially anything for Senate District 36?
Well, let's look at this, and it's across the board, right? Workforce within the home and community-based services. It makes absolutely zero sense that, you know, on one hand, the state of Minnesota, which in the first time in history, we have more people 65 and older, right? So we have than we do in the K-12 education system. So we got this growing group of individuals 65 and older, and we want to keep people in their homes, right? That's a value we all want to share, right? Well, what do you need? You need some home and community-based service providers to go in there. But if your reimbursement rates are at $14.60 an hour, and I can go and get a job at Burnsville McDonald's starting at $21 an hour, something's wrong with that, right? And so it's not keeping up. The home and community-based services. So workforce incentives, what else can we put on the table? You know, if you want to go back to school, how can we pay for your schooling? If you want to get a career letter going, how can we get you in there so you want to become a nurse? You can do it, right? But at the same time, also increase money to be able to help offset some of the fact that folks in home and community-based services can't compete against the other providers out there, right, of services. And so, and I mean services like food service or whatever it is. And so one of the things we talk about is, you know, what can we do to really, really look at helping with the workforce issue? Not just the home and community base, but also our nursing homes. You're talking 23,000 job vacancies in one of the sectors and 20,000 in the other. So you have 43,000 people job vacancies within those sectors in our aging and compassionate care for elderly and people with disabilities. We got to do something about it. That's number one. Number two, because of that workforce, group homes are shutting down, right? Mm-hmm. So you got group homes that are shutting the doors. You know, you talk about compassionate care for people. If all of a sudden we can't support our group homes, which are, you know, true and tied for, you know, tried and true for the state of Minnesota for many, many years, it's like something's wrong with that. We need to deal with that. And then, I'll get a little wonky. I mean, we need to recodify the DWR system, the disability waiver rate system service in Minnesota. You need to recodify it in law to make it consistent with what the Centers for Medicaid Services say we should be doing. And that's what we'll do. So that'll be a big policy discussion. The other one is the ABLE Act, you know, which we were one of the first states to really look at that. ABLE Act was to allow people to put money into a trust to take care of, you know, compassionate care for people that might have a special health care need. And so that needs to get consistent with some of the federal pieces. And then we're still looking at some child care initiatives that need to be looked at because, you know, if we don't have a good child care system in the state of Minnesota, you can't get people to work because people are going to have to be at home. And so it's like, huh, how do you find the balancing act there? And so that'll definitely come into our existence. And then on the aging and long-term care, you know, we're still going to be dealing with the nursing home situation. Again, it's workforce, but it's also some of the regulations within nursing home. How are we ensuring we're getting compassionate care? And I keep using the word compassionate care because that's what it's about, right? As our population is increasing, the aging is increasing. We're also seeing a need on the Medicaid side of that, right? You go from, you know, 900,000 people to now 1.1 or 1.3 million people 65 and older. And I told you K-12 education is 850,000 kids, right? But mm-hmm. now you're in a million and, you know, million and up, and it's going. The Medicaid cost is going to go from $1 billion to $3 billion in the next 2 years, right? And I think we might even be close to that $3 billion hit right now. That's just to provide the care for our folks that are going to be on, you know, medical assistance as elderly people, right? And so it's like, all right, how are we going to be able to deliver, you know, investments within those structures to do it? And I think now is the time to do it. I mean, if you look at the forecast, if the forecast stays, Matt, right, $7.7 billion forecast, right? So $3 billion goes to the bank to pay the bank because we owe the bank money. And then we got the uninsurance piece too. You know, we do the trust was spent down. We owe the feds $1.3 billion. And then, of course, to make that trust whole, you got to add another $1.3 or $1.4 billion to that, right? So it's the debate is, all right, so what do you do with that? So let's say you take that. That still gives you $3 or $4 billion that can go and really do some infrastructure support and create some good paying jobs to people, right? And at the same time, we also need to, you know, get some tax breaks for people that have paid, small businesses and the mom and pops, you know, the middle class tax cuts. So I think it's going to be a busy session, Matt. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping all the things I just threw up at you, you know, are going to be, you know, talked about. And there's more.
Well,
there's tons of more stuff.
Well, right? just what you're saying, though, is this is how you get things done, is because you know your facts. And this is if you just listen to the last 5 minutes of the senator, you know why he's able to get not only the DFL on board, but also some Republicans on board, too, because he knows his stuff, and he's just dealing with stuff, which is just no-brainer things to do. Quickly here, your caucus tonight in 36. How are you guys doing it up there?
Contactless, right? Okay. We're going to be hanging out at the school. People can drive up. You can, you know, hand your stuff, say hi. You know, we're still being very cautious of the fact that, you know, I don't want to, you know, a whole bunch of people in a room. So,
yeah.
You know, we need to, you know, priority A, take care of each other. Right.
Yep.
So contactless, that's what we're doing.
All right. And then go ahead.
If it's at Champlin Park High School, people want to come by and drop off their forms to want to be part of the, you know, the convention that's going to happen in March, then, you know, bring it, go on to the website, the Secretary of State's office or the DFL website, and you can print out the form. You can do that or send me an email at, john@johnhoffmanmn.com, and I can send you a link to that as well. So
I believe it's minvotes.com, mmvotes.org is for the state, the Minnesota
Perfect.
Secretary of State. And that will tell you not only if you're in 36 what the details are, but any district. You can find out at the Minnesota Secretary of State's website how to participate in the caucuses tonight. Your campaign, johnhoffmanmn.com, correct?
That is correct. It's all one word, johnhoffmanmn.com. Go check it out. There's a note about being in unprecedented times, and we're trying to keep each other safe, and we need to try keeping afloat and working together to get through this, right? Mm-hmm. I still believe in that. So
johnhoffmanmn.com. If for no other reason, go up there and do some door knocking for Senator Hoffman for this reason. They're great restaurants up there. He'll give you some suggestions on where you can dine after you knock on some doors. The district is quite nice up there in 36. Senator John Hoffman, Democrat of the day. Senator, thank you very much. All my best on the caucus tonight and all my best in this upcoming year, my friend.
And all my best to you and everybody at AM 950. It's my favorite station. That's why I always I advertise on 950 AM. So you guys are great. So be well.
Thank you very much, sir. Senator John Hoffman is Democrat of the day. We'll take a break, wrap up hour one. When we do return, it's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Well, the show is better with Lizzo. Let's just be honest. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll spotlight Senator John Hoffman, obviously, as Democrat of the day. It is caucus night, and I think that it is it's very important to get out and participate if you can. I don't know. Did you see quickly? You know, someone who's not going to probably participate in a good constructive way. Representative Skin Tag Eric Mortensen down in Shakopee, right? You see, the governor brought him a lemon bar. The governor's walking around the Capitol yesterday with lemon bars, and he's like, "I don't need this. Why aren't you free?" Remember who's the loon ball nutcase that was down in Albert Lee with the coffee house that didn't want to shut down her business, and she fled to Iowa and. You know, she got put into jail. Do you remember who that is?
Don't remember her name specifically.
Anyway, he was saying, "Why aren't you releasing her? Why aren't you releasing her?" Come on. I appreciate John Hoffman and being able to work with the other side of the aisle, but some of these clowns on the other side, needless to say, you want to prevent these clowns from getting in there. Caucus! MNVotes.org. MNVotes.org. That's the Minnesota Secretary of State's page. Pull it up right now. Important changes on COVID information. Caucus Finder. Caucus Finder. There it is. Click on it. We'll ask you your zip code, your house number. Then it will ask you what street you're on. It will tell you exactly where you need a caucus, what kind of caucus you're having, whether it's remote or in person. You can find all the information there from our fine, outstanding Secretary of State, Steve Simon. MNVotes.org, MNVotes.org. Go participate. It's an important thing. It is absolutely an important thing. We are going to take a break. Hour two, lock and loaded. We have got a huge hour with two interviews coming up in. Just stay with us right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show for your Tuesday. Good to be with you. Matt Brett loaded this hour. Peter Callahan from MinPost going to join us in a little bit. Jack Rice going to chime in on the trial of the three police officers. We'll get to him at about 5:35. Brett, we've got a new candidate for governor in the state.
Oh, I've heard, yes.
Former Hennepin County Sheriff Rick Stanek is running for governor. The 59-year-old announced his candidacy Tuesday with a website. What was the... with a website and campaign video during which he touts his law enforcement credentials while emphasizing public safety as his top priority. I was a street cop and a sheriff. Oh, we'll get back to that in a sec. Stanek says in the nearly 2-minute video, by the way, how many times did he use inappropriate language? Never mind. I'll get to that in a second, too. But no matter what uniform I'm wearing, my goal has always been the same. Uphold the law, protect my neighbors. Sure it has. Stanek served as sheriff of Minnesota's largest county from 2007 to 2019 when he was defeated by current Hennepin County Sheriff Dave Hutchinson. Prior to that, he spent 20 years working as Minneapolis police officer. During that span, he also served 5 terms as a state representative and spent about 15 months as commissioner in the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. He resigned from the latter post over accusations he screamed racial slurs at a Liberian man while on duty as a police officer in 1989. Apparently, the N-word. MinPost has previously reported, and during a deposition, Stanek admitted to telling racist jokes with other officers because, hey, racism. I mean, once again, this is not like one guy who snapped. Well, first of all, I don't care who you are. If you snap and the first thing you do is racism, you know, that's not how it works. That's kind of underlying there. That's kind of a prominent feature. That being said, you kind of were doing a lot of that, so I'm sure though you've had sensitivity training. I will say this, he's got no chance come the general election because you have to win some of the suburbs, but even in Minneapolis-St. Paul, such blatant racism is not tolerated as far as candidates go, and so he's, you know, even out in the tertiary suburbs, no, people aren't going to fly. That's not going to fly. MinPost has pointed out he also faced scrutiny for claims that he made about the response to the 35W bridge collapse and for sending Hennepin County law enforcement officers to North Dakota to assault Native Americans over the Dakota Access Pipeline. So I don't think Stanek's going to be getting the Native American vote either in the state of Minnesota. But don't get me wrong. I mean, I think you and I both know the thing about Stanek is that this does play when it comes to getting elected. This kind of history. Did you hear what I did in 1989? Almost bragging about it, I imagine, out in some of these areas, because that's what people want to hear. And yeah, I don't think it nearly is as crippling for him on the Republican side. He's got no chance, though, if it comes to the general election.
Oh, I agree. He's a big contender for the Republican nomination. General election, yeah, that's going to be an uphill battle for him.
Do you know what my favorite thing right now on the Republican side is? The almost like daily affirmations from Senator Michelle Benson about, I'm really a far-right loon ball.
Kind of sounds like Mitt Romney in 2012.
It's more like Stuart Smalley. You know,
even better. Yes,
I got to tell you, I will. I really think, you know. I don't want to. I'm gonna paraphrase. She hasn't said any of the things I'm about to say. She is saying. But you kind of will get the idea from what I'm saying. To kind of paraphrase or kind of like, I think children should have guns all the time. Lock and loaded should be a law. I think that we should. I watch Handmaid's Tale. And boy, I think that's just the way of life it should be in this state. I just think she did not say this. Once again, we sometimes make jokes here at the radio station. We're kind of making a joke. Is Zelka or Jensen, though? I still think it's going to be Gazelka or Jensen. And, okay, when I think about Paul Gazelka, you know, magnetism, energetic, exciting, those are just not words that come to mind, you know, with Paul Gazelka. They just don't. It's basically a large jar of marshmallow fluff that's been out in the sun for a while. That's kind of what I get.
You're saying he's not a very charismatic guy. Yeah.
He's kind of missing it a little bit. Boy, Jensen, he's a little charismatic, but I think the Republicans are terrified. There is a growing cult of moderate Republicans who are desperately trying to derail Jensen because they are scared Jensen's going to be it. And it's clear. You know, if you hear them talking about it, I mean, do I really think they're going to go off too much on Stanek? Probably not. Or any of the other, like, who's the guy from, like, Lexington or something like that that's running for the GOP nomination? No, they don't care about those guys. They have no chance. So when I constantly see Republicans bashing on Jensen, they're scared of Jensen because there's no – you're not going to be able to walk back a lot of that stuff. And I think that that's going to – without the Senate race on the statewide race, Jensen's going to be – you know, whoever the Republican nominee for governor is going to be the bellwether. And – it could be Jensen.
Do you think he wins the straw poll tonight hands down for the Republicans? I could see him easily getting like 40%. I think he's going to be hugely popular with that base.
I think he will because, yeah, you really can't stop the caucus. You know, that's kind of getting in the temperature reading of the room. I think he will finish second behind Gazelka, but not by much. And – reminder, if you're the Republicans and you're looking at, you know, what you consider to be traditional Republican, same as always before, versus, you know, the kind of the new way the Republican Party is going, I think Jensen's going to come back on that. I think if you're Jensen right now, you're playing with house money. You know, you should not be there as well as he has. He's done a good campaign. To control the Republican Party, he did a good campaign, but it will be a nightmare for Republicans if he becomes a nominee because they are going to have to spend millions of dollars to get people to try to forget his record when it comes to the general election. So, the one main story we do want to make sure I mention here before we get into the next interview is once again the shooting in Richfield. Richfield Police Chief saying the two victims were shot outside of the South Education Center Academy at 1207 while on the sidewalk outside of the school in the 7400 block of Penn Avenue South. One has passed away from the shooting. The other one is in critical condition. A tragic day. The school is a charter school down there with about 200 students. So it had been on lockdown for the good chunk of the day. Still no arrests in the shooting, although it does sound like they are in the process of trying to track down who exactly was involved. I'm obviously this is going to be a developing story. There'll be more on this to come. But this is a, you know, going on to different things here. It is caucus night. Peter Callahan. Oh, when you say big hot cans of steaming excitement, Peter Callahan's always one that comes to mind for me. He covers, this might be his last interview.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you very much. I've lost that pipeline.
Let's enjoy Peter Callahan while we can. He, of course, the political reporter for MinnPost, the fine organization MinnPost.
Indeed, yeah. Obviously, he covers a lot of the state capitol. And I figure, well, we're at the beginning of the legislative session. We'll talk about that. And then he has a nice preview of what's going on with caucuses right now and why Republicans are going nuts about the DFL caucuses, which we'll get into for silly reasons, as we can probably expect.
Yes, indeed. Well, here you go. Peter Callahan from MinnPost right here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson with you here on a Tuesday afternoon. We're joined now by Peter Callahan, who covers state government for MinnPost, website minnpost.com, for the latest in Minnesota news and politics as the state legislature just got back in session. That's a big news story we'll be talking about in terms of where we could see some areas of agreement between the DFL and the GOP. And then tonight is caucus night, as we'll be talking with that Peter about that as well. Peter, thanks so much for joining me on the show today. Appreciate it.
You bet. Good to be here, Brett.
So it's interesting tonight with precinct caucuses taking place, because on paper you would think the Republicans should be garnering all the attention, being that they have to nominate someone to run for governor this fall. Meanwhile, the DFL side has Governor Tim Walz, the incumbent, who's really not facing any organized challengers. But yet a lot of folks are paying attention to what's happening in the DFL caucuses this year. Peter, explain why this has been a thing and why people are kind of following along with what's been happening with the DFL and precinct caucuses.
Yeah, right. They've got statewide offices for which we have no announced, declared opposition. There'll certainly be legislative races that are looking for endorsements that will start at the caucus level, or, say, Hennepin County Attorney with a getting more crowded field. But because they don't have a statewide issue on their ballot in their primary, that's much less of interest. But it sort of got more interesting last week when the state DFL announced that they would, for the first time, allow non-registered voters, meaning people who are not eligible to be registered voters, people who have been released from incarceration but are still on probation or supervised release, and people who are not yet citizens, say Dreamers or other immigrants who are not documented.
So as I understand it right now, state law basically says that only eligible voters can participate in caucuses. So my question is, how did the DFL find a way around this law? I believe it had to do with a lawsuit they filed a while back, correct?
Yeah, the DFL sued Secretary of State Steve Simon, who is just sort of the recipient of suits like this. It's not like he was doing anything, or he's not even the person who would enforce that 45-year-old state law that county attorneys would. And they said, we get to decide who takes part in our process. It's a private organization, and the state should not have any say over that. And they sued him and got to the district court, and the district court dismissed the suit, saying this isn't really right because nothing is happening to you. Nobody is, you know, threatening you or enforcing this law. So they got a court of appeals to take the case, and the court of appeals upheld the district court decision and never really got to the fundamental First Amendment free association case that the DFL had brought. They just said the same thing. The way we read the statute, the court said the penalties, the criminal penalties for violating that prohibition do not apply to caucuses. They only apply to voting in a primary or a general election or a special election. And therefore, since you're facing no threat, we just don't think this case is valid and needs to be before us. We're not going to give you an advisory opinion if there really isn't a threat to you. But the law, the statute itself stays on the books, and it is, by state law, a violation of that state law for caucuses to receive votes from non-registered voters and non-eligible voters. So the DFL proceeds. Nobody's going to, you know, go after them, I don't think. Although I guess you could say there could be a Republican county attorney out in greater Minnesota who might think he or she could make some political hay by going after the local DFL. But what it does for a lot of Democrats is it just kind of opens the issue of voter fraud, which is kind of which is proven to be unfounded, has proven to be sort of propaganda and sour grapes on the part of Republicans, including President Trump. But this sort of amplifies the notion that, see, this group of party people are trying to get votes from people who aren't eligible. And it just handed an issue to the Republicans in the state that otherwise wouldn't have been there.
Another thing that I think is important to point out with what the DFL is doing tonight with precinct caucuses is that when they allow non-residents to participate, this only applies to the caucuses. This has nothing to do with Election Day since, well, any changes to who can vote on Election Day has to be done by the state legislature. So I think that's an important distinction to point out, that this only affects caucuses that are taking place tonight.
Sure, correct. I mean, and then suddenly you have Steve Simon and county elections official involved because they do patrol and endorse and enforce election laws. There is a bit of a trend nationally, and calling it a trend is probably an exaggeration, but New York City voted to allow non-residents, U.S. citizens, to vote in city elections. And there is a proposal, I don't know if the ordinance has been introduced yet, but in Minneapolis City Council to do the same thing in Minneapolis. And their point was that they're only voting in our local elections, and we should be able to decide who votes. And there's so many people there who whose life is impacted by what city councils do that the New York City Council decided it would be fair and just to let them have a say in who runs that city.
And going back to the Republican caucuses now, because that's at least in terms of voting where the big action is going to be tonight as the Republicans are conducting a straw poll for governor. Is there any indication in terms of how that vote might go, or is there really any way we can possibly predict how a straw poll vote can go? I know that's always tough, being that it's not necessarily official, being that it's just a straw poll.
Sure. I mean, it's important to remember that the nominee for governor will be determined in the August primary. But the Republican Party has been very good at enforcing or convincing Republican voters to go along with the endorsement that comes out of the state convention. I mean, I had to go back 30 years to find a non-endorsed candidate in a contested Republican primary who won despite not getting the endorsement. The D's don't do that so much. I mean, Walls wasn't endorsed. Mark Dayton wasn't endorsed in his first term. But the R's do tend to put a lot of value in that. So you get to May in Rochester, and 2,200 Republicans are likely to decide who is running against Tim Walls in November. So tonight's the first night for that, and the straw poll is of interest, and it certainly is an indication. But what's more important is how many people for, say, Michelle Benson get elected at a precinct caucus to go to the next level of conventions, Senate district or local organizing group conventions, and then say to county and larger group conventions. So this starts that process. And while the straw poll is interesting and is perhaps a barometer of levels of support, what's really more important is that people who are getting elected as delegate to subsequent conventions.
Speaking with Peter Callahan, who covers state government for MinnPost, website is minnpost.com, and encourage you to check out his piece tonight, Why Everyone is Talking About the DFL Precinct Caucuses This Year. I want to move on to another story you wrote, Peter, and that is where the Minnesota legislature may find agreement and where it probably won't find agreement during this legislative session. Running through some of these categories where the DFL and GOP could possibly find some areas where they could come together with a bill, one has to be tax cuts, being that Minnesota has a record budget surplus coming up during this cycle. Governor Tim Walz has proposed releasing what are called kind of Walz checks, similar to the old Jesse checks we had back in the early 2000s. Republicans certainly always favor in tax cuts, always in favor of tax cuts. So talk about how that could be an area where the DFL and the Republicans could come together, even though Republicans were a little bit cool towards the idea of Walls checks.
Well, they're certainly cool to the idea of calling them Walls checks. And the governor said, well, I was just following what Jesse Ventura did 20 years ago, and they were called Jesse checks. I was not here yet, Brett, but I cannot find that Jesse Ventura christened them Jesse checks. I think pundits and newsies and others came in after the fact and started calling them Jesse checks. I mean, he was a well-known self-promoter. If he'd had the opportunity to name them himself, he probably would have. But what is of interest here is that there is so much money in this surplus, and we're not used to it. We're used to $1.6 billion surpluses where you have to decide to do this or that. You have to decide to do some tax cut or some spending increases or some saving. This thing is so big, you can do this and that and that. So initially, we are getting a cool reception to the idea of rebates, but that has picked up because I think legislative leaders realize they would be pretty popular, and they do not take away from their financial ability to do, say, ongoing tax cuts if you're the Republicans or some spending proposal if you're DFLers. So they don't have to choose. They can do it all.
Let's talk about another area where that's certainly going to garner a lot of attention. That has to do with public safety, especially with recent crime waves, not just in Minnesota, but around the entire country. Even though the DFL and GOP on paper are pretty far apart, they do at least have a little bit of history in terms of working together, trying to come up with public safety measures. What could they be looking at during this legislative session?
Well, the interesting thing is that 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, Republicans made a lot of, took political advantage of crime issues in the greater Twin Cities area. And there are Republican legislators who are in office right now because they beat DFL incumbents, particularly in the suburbs, on that issue primarily. And the DFL has been realizing that they're in something of a box. They are in favor of continuing social justice and police reform measures, but they have this apparent crime issue, and it's real. But you know how real it is and how local it is a bigger question mark, and they feel politically they have got to respond to it. And whether it's too late, whether it will matter, I'm not sure, but all four caucuses are making crime fighting and crime prevention parts of their agendas. And the Democrats certainly emphasize prevention and interventions over enforcement, but there is some of that. And Republicans definitely emphasize enforcement and incarceration over prevention, but there is some of that in their proposal as well.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up, too, that it is an issue that Republicans were successful running on back in 2020. You wonder if they even have motivations to find a compromise on this, being that, well, they can just continue hammering the DFL on this like they did back in 2020. So at least the politics adds a wrinkle to that issue as well.
It does, but it doesn't take away. If they actually accomplish something, it doesn't take away from that issue. You saw that Rich Stanek declared for governor today, and he's definitely running on a law and order platform. And you will see the same footage. It's sort of the bingo card of the election this year. There's the flames from a fire during the riots in the two cities. There's the picture of Ilhan. There's the picture of walls. I mean, they kind of touch on all these things, and they will be emphasizing COVID responses, particularly in the schools, and they'll be talking about crime and pushing on walls in the DFL for what they consider to be a failure to respond to crime over the last 2 years. And the DFL has got to figure out a way to respond to that. And so I think some things will pass in that area. There will be money sent out to cities to, you know, if they want to hire mental health interveners, they can do that with the money. If they want to hire more cops, they can do that with the money. If they want to recruit or pay bonuses or retention bonuses, they could do that. But there will be money sent out for those functions, I'm pretty sure.
Let's go to another section where there might be some agreement between the DFL and the GOP, and that has to do with the unemployment insurance relief, since that was tapped when COVID first started here in Minnesota. And now that money has to be repaid, and if it's not, it could lead to businesses paying significantly higher premiums. So motivation, or the business community at least, pressuring members of the legislature to get this paid back by using some of that budget surplus we have right now. And what's interesting, as I read through what you wrote on this, Peter, is that there is some disagreement within the DFL on whether they should pay back this fund or how much should they pay it back, which puts them in an interesting place, being that Republicans are largely on board with getting this paid back, while there are still some disagreements within the DFL.
Yeah, Republicans and Governor Walz are almost in complete agreement that $2.7 billion from the surplus should go to two sources. One, repaying a little over $1 billion in borrowing from the federal government, which is the standard for recessions. You know, states drain their unemployment trust funds, and then they're allowed to borrow from the federal treasury, and then they're required to pay that loan back over a period of time. It might be 8 years or 10 years, but they pay it back with some interest. They then have to put another $1.7 billion eventually into the trust fund, because that's what the federal government requires a state the size of Minnesota to have in the bank for future recessions. When this one started, Minnesota didn't have $1.7 billion. It had about $1 billion. So it drained that, borrowed another $1 billion from the feds. Had the surplus been what it should have been, the borrowing would have been a lot less. So those are the two things that happen, and both have to come without intervention from the legislature and the governor. Both have to come from premiums paid by employers, not just businesses. I work for a nonprofit. We pay into unemployment compensation trust fund as well, and it's something that would be the only intervention during the COVID recession that wasn't paid for essentially by federal borrowing. All the excess unemployment paid during the recession, the $600 monthly or weekly top-offs, the benefits for gig workers, contract workers, PPP loans, stimulus checks to people, business loans, restaurant loans, all of that was paid for by federal borrowing and a little bit of state funds. This would be the only significant intervention that would be paid for by some form of taxation. So I think that's the argument that Walz made. He said, I shut you down. I'm the one who, or we as a state, are the ones who caused this unemployment spike. And now it's fair to use collective money, and in fact, heavily federal money, because we're still spending federal ARPA money to pay that back.
Well, we'll create some challenges at the Capitol to figure out how that fund gets repaid back here during this upcoming session. Well, you have been speaking with Peter Callahan, covers state government for MinnPost, website minnpost.com. For the latest in Minnesota news and politics, you can check out his two most recent pieces. One, why everyone is talking about the DFL precinct caucuses this year, and the other, where the Minnesota legislature may find agreement and where it probably won't this legislative session. Again, find those over at minnpost.com. Peter, as always, thanks for the time today. Appreciate you coming on the show.
Good talking to you, Brett.
All right, let's take a break and then send things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Busy day today. Once again, we've got the Peter Callahan interview. Of course, Senator John Hoffman a little earlier as Democrat of the day. Jack Rice is kind enough to join us right now. JackRiceLaw.com. JackRiceLaw.com, the best defense attorney here in the state of Minnesota. He's kind enough today to join us to talk about the current trial going on of the three other police officers that were present in the when the murder of George Floyd happened. Jack, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Absolutely. Great to be with you.
You're getting a lot of run on court TV. Nicely done, sir.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I think part of what it is, it goes like this, is that if you've done enough trials and you've done it enough times, sometimes you'll go, oh, I shouldn't have done that, and you'll always remember it. Say, don't do this. You know, sometimes that's the nature of experience. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it is. And by the way, that experience shines through on what I'm the first thing I'm going to bring up today. You and I talked during the Chauvin trial and said, you know, if Derek Chauvin came on out and threw the Minneapolis Police Department under the bus and basically said the training is bad, because, I mean, there were clear hints that the training was inferior, was substandard. And we said that he might actually have a legitimate defense if he just was willing to throw the Minneapolis Police Department under the bus. He didn't do that. He was found guilty. These three other officers, they indeed have this seems like the tactic they're going with is that they're going out there, King, Thomas Lane, and Tao. They're basically going with the mentality of, this police department was horrible at training. They should have trained us better, and they just didn't. And I still stand by what you and I said back with the Chauvin trial. I think this actually might get them off the charges against them.
No, I think you're right. I mean, you're right. Off air, you and I were talking about this a lot. This idea that going after the department really meant something. And here was really why. If you look back at the Chauvin trial, here was my problem. My problem was is, you got Arredondo who takes the stand. You have his senior officers who take the stand and say, oh, no, this is not what we are. This is not what we do. And you get the training officers out coming and saying, oh, this is not what we train. This is not where we are. And the problem is that ignores lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit after unreasonable use of force again and again to the point that it becomes policy. It happens so much, so many times. It was laughable. And you look at this case, obviously the settlement for more than $20 million. You look at the case involving Officer Moore, that was a settlement for $20 million. And that list goes on and on and on, which tells you the approach of the Minneapolis Police Department. And what you're seeing right now with Lane, King, and Tao is they're going straight at the training division and at the policies of this department itself.
And it's what's interesting is not only are we seeing cracks in the training through this trial, there was a story that just came on about the excited delirium that, you know, that within the training of with excited delirium, when they in 2018 came back and said, you know, no, you're not supposed to do this anymore. The police basically said, ignore this. This is what we're going to still do. And it's only September of last year when there was a ballot initiative that was about who was going to control the Minneapolis police that finally the Minneapolis police went out there and adopted the recommendation from 2018. There clearly is a massive level of incompetent training that's going on within the Minneapolis Police Department. I think it not only is it showing in the training, but in the end result of the policing that we're getting in the city.
Well, and the reason that it matters, Matt, is this, is that if we think about what these officers are doing and what it is that the prosecution must prove, is they must prove that these officers knew that what they were doing was wrong, but that they did it anyway. I mean, that's sort of a layman's way of putting it, but that's actually what it means. They knew what they were doing was wrong, but they did it anyway. Now, if we know that's the case, then the question is, did they know what they were doing? That's the first piece here. And the only way they're going to know what they're doing is that if they're being trained on it. If you use that example that you had yourself, this example that basically said that the department told officers to ignore very specific findings when it came to the police and what the paramedics were telling them to do and what it was actually doing. So in other words, ignore what the paramedics are saying. Now think about that for a second, because it comes back to, did they know that what they were doing was wrong? Remember, Lane, as an example, he was on the beat. He was an officer for a grand total of 4 working days when this happened. If he has substandard or completely incompetent training, and then he's on the beat for 4 days. Oh, let me add an additional one. They were told to never, never argue with instructors. The senior officer at the time was Derek Chauvin. Mr. Lane, Officer Lane, asked him twice, should we turn him over? The first time, Chauvin said no. The second time, and he asked a second time, Chauvin ignored him completely. Remember, the standard is You were told to never argue with instructors. Think about what that means.
Well, what's interesting about this is that, okay, so and just I'm going to go with this standard training. Because I was in the military. In the military, you have standard training, and because you have a tendency of dealing with things which are quite dangerous, you do have to sign off on getting certain training. And I'm presuming the same process goes on with the police department, that once you sit down and you go through training, say it's weapons training, that you sit down and you sign the thing saying, I went through training on this date. Which then leads this, that if the training was contradictory to what was actually being being signed, that are being taught, that the what you signed that you were taught wasn't what was taught there, how much culpability do the three officers have then if they were saying, hey, yeah, I know what I signed, but what we were told during these training sessions didn't match any of that, but we were still told to sign the paper anyway?
That's the rub, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because if what you're told is, you check this box to say that you were trained. And by the way, that's what the department is doing again. They're saying, oh, we trained these people. But it's only under cross-examination that they came back and they said, oh, by the way, we have no training at all or scenarios for how officers are supposed to intervene. Meaning, if they see something wrong, what are they supposed to do? Well, they have no training scenarios at all. This is according to their senior head of training for the Minneapolis Police Department, during cross-examination, came out and said, we have no interventions in place on how scenarios should be done. You're told that you're never supposed to interrupt or argue with instructors. You're told that you're supposed to ignore the findings as it applies to what paramedics are saying versus what the police are saying. So in other words, you're quote-unquote trained to do one thing, check the box, but we're telling you what the answer is. What you're supposed to do. In other words, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, say no more.
Mm-hmm. It does bring up an interesting argument of, you know, how, you know, then do you hold these people accountable for a murder because they filled out paperwork incorrectly? And sometimes that's the catch, you know, sometimes that's a catch. I mean, isn't that how they got Capone and tax fraud? It's like, or, you know, you if you're dotting I's, crossing T's on official forms, you're held accountable for that. And so even though the training was substandard or didn't match any of the things that you signed, you still are responsible for that.
Well, and that's the issue. I mean, frankly, when we look at what this prosecution is actually about, the prosecution of these three former officers is really about intervention. And what it really is if you see something bad, you are supposed to stop it. And in fact, the prosecution in this case is not about what they did. It's about what they failed to do. And the argument is they received sufficient training, proper training, and the standard is the same for any officer, whether they're on the first day on the beat or they're 19 days on the beat. Now, we have three different officers. I think Lane is in the best position to very likely walk in a case like this.
Yeah.
But Powell, as an example, by the way, he's had six complaints against him, including a 2017 federal lawsuit for excessive use of force. And so if he takes the stand, all of that could roll out to a jury. And I think that could hurt Powell, but believe it or not, that could actually help somebody like Elaine, who apparently is going to testify, according to Earl Gray, his attorney.
Could Lane bring that up then at the trial, or is that you know, I'm, you know, could he say, hey, I don't have a record like these other guys?
Yes. Oh. Well, what he could say is, look, this is why I wanted to be a police officer. This is what I was trained to do, and this is what they told me to do. This is what I understood to be right, and what I understood to be wrong. And in fact, I also depend upon my senior officers. That's the reason I was in training and I was the junior guy. That's the reason I asked Officer Chauvin more than once. By the way, we know that Lane not only asked Chauvin to turn over George Floyd twice, the person who called the paramedic was Officer Lane. The person who actually helped the paramedic work on George Floyd, it was Officer Lane. So these are all things that Lane could say to the jury and say, I'm four days in. I'm doing the best that I know how to do. And with the training that I received, who said, do this, do this, do this, What else could I have done? I did everything I thought I was supposed to do. The state must still convince this jury. The feds in this case must convince this jury beyond a reasonable doubt that all three of these men are guilty of these crimes. And that is a burden that they're going to have to carry.
I agree with you. I think where you're going and where I'm going is I think Lane is going to walk. And I think the other two officers might have a little more harder time. But I think, you do put out a good point. And if Lane is willing, going back to what you and I discussed at the Chauvin trial, if you throw the department under the bus, if you throw the other two guys under the bus, you know, it's and you basically point out I was the only one that was trying to help Floyd on the scene, then it does become a pretty good argument that you, at least you're going to get that once again, the doubt there. You create the doubt and whether or not that they follow through on him. I just don't know, will the jury then look at it as all three officers get the same, or can you separate that out?
Well, that really is the difficulty now, because we can look at all these issues and we could say they should have received better training, and yet at the same time, we have a horrifying 9.5-minute tape. We're watching these four men murder somebody in the street. Or at least one man murdered somebody and the other three are watching it happen and doing nothing about it. Is it so heinous that it's obvious that they should have done something or they should have done more? And I think that videotape is going to drive them in such a way that they could all still be found guilty of it. I think of the three, however, the person who is the least culpable is the brand new officer who frankly did a whole lot of things right. The one thing that I think Chauvin failed to do in that trial, and what they should have done in that trial, as you and I have just discussed, is this issue of the policies, the procedures of the Minneapolis Police Department. Because honestly, when I watched Aaron Donovan take the stand and his senior officers take the stand and say, this is not who we are, my response is, I've got 20 years of experience to tell you otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, really? Let me show you some news stories, because apparently you've not been keeping track.
I've had multiple cases in my career in Minneapolis where I have seen things happen, and these officers remained officers when it was done. And my response is, if we know that the likes of a Derek Chauvin did what he did in 2017 to that 14-year-old boy, he was still a cop. Yeah. So it tells me that you lean on somebody's neck and you're fine with it and nobody cares. That tells you that that's policy. It may say it's not, but if you don't care, if nobody gets sanctioned in any way whatsoever for it, it tells you that it's the unwritten rule that applies to all. That's a problem for the Minneapolis Police Department, and should be, by the way.
I would say this, too. If I was one of these officers, I'd bring the Stallings tape in and saying, this is 3 days afterward, 2 days afterwards, and take a look. I mean, they clearly are not following any of their training, and none of these officers have been held accountable. I mean, because that also then gets kind of, proves the point. It wasn't just beforehand. It was afterwards as well. There was just no intent on fixing that police department. Today, final thing for you. Today, they went after Andrew Baker. This is the medical examiner. I just don't think they got any hits on him. I mean, it was kind of a rehash of the Chauvin trial, trying to question whether or not he was being honest. Was he being pressured? The reality is that he was pretty straightforward. He seemed to actually give some pretty decent answers. And if they're trying to negate the medical examination, I don't think they got any hits on that.
No, I agree with you completely. In fact, one of the things that I do when I'm teaching and I train both prosecutors and defense attorneys across the United States and even around the world, is that when you're approaching a trial, you have a central theme, what your case is about. And I would argue what this case is about is that these officers simply didn't know that what they were doing was wrong. The problem is if you start doing this sort of shotgun, scattershot effort where you sort of bite at every little thing, sometimes what it does is it actually waters down what you're saying and it starts to feel like an excuse. In this particular case, they actually have something that they can really hold on to. And they should, because there is something here that I think is critically important, not just about what happened to George Floyd, but also the fact that this department represents the people of Minneapolis, and they have obligations to all of them, as well as to George Floyd. But these officers shouldn't be sacrificial lambs simply because they failed to do what they do. If they failed, so be it. Find them guilty. If they didn't, you don't get to say, oh, bad apples, which they're going to do, bad apples, and then they just move on along their way and do exactly what they did previously. That's a very real problem.
Best defense attorney in Minneapolis, St. Paul, hands down, is Jack Rice. If you have a question about a case, sit down, talk with him. He'll give you an honest opinion and an honest evaluation. JackRiceLaw.com, JackRiceLaw.com. It's Jack Rice Defense. Jack, an absolute privilege as always. I imagine we'll talk before too long with the trial, okay?
Whatever you need, you know that.
Thank you, sir. I always appreciate it. Jack Rice joining us. We'll spotlight that interview as well. We'll take a break. Come on back. The Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. This is the Matt McNeil Show. Speaking of bad training here, Unicorn Riot, who are exceptional. Now, by the way, I want to give Racket Minnesota credit because they basically brought this story out there, and I'm going to quote them as they said, either the Minneapolis Police Department had no idea what they were doing or they knew exactly what they were doing. It's one of the two, and I agree with them wholeheartedly. Unicorn Riot obtained documents used to train Minneapolis Police Department on political extremism. The training presentation is entitled Political Extremists, Anarchists, a Brief Summary of Groups that Border the Line Between Protest and Domestic Terrorism. The Minneapolis Police Department document discusses the so-called Boogaloo Movement as well as the anti-fascist movement known commonly as Antifa. The training materials prepared by the Minneapolis Police Department intelligence analysts reveal that they are targeting of individuals for expressing political speech. Additionally, Minneapolis Police Department demonstrates misunderstanding of Antifa as well as the threat posed by Boogaloo Boy members. And by the way, it doesn't sound like there's too much talk in this training about extremism, like white extremists, white nationalists, that sort of thing, which you'd think that that would be a large part of this, but not. Through misunderstanding or political bias, the Minneapolis Police Department analyst made wildly inaccurate claims about the organization and structure of Antifa. Antifa is famously decentralized and has no official headquarters or leadership, contrary to the near conspiracy theorizing present in the Minneapolis Police Department documents. By contrast, the Boogaloo's apocalyptic dynamic was noted by the Minneapolis Police Department intelligence analyst who assembled the training materials. As with many paranoid-soaked reports about anti-fascist, Minneapolis police conflates different types of protests and activity under a sprawling label of Antifa. Local mutual aid products and black bloc-style direct actions, as usual, are implied to be part of the dreaded Antifa octopus rather than the separate, sometimes overlapping elements to the contemporary political scene. So basically, they're just labeling anything. It sounds like what they're doing is labeling anything that has to do with black people as Antifa. Minneapolis Police Department's slant attempts to roll the giant Antifa snowman out of deep rifts of discontent wafting through Minneapolis. This kind of fabrication could entice prosecutors to file conspiracy charges on the basis of political orientation. So basically they're saying if people are making political speeches, they labeled that as Antifa. As far back as 2017, some authorities in that state sought to label anti-fascists as street gangs. Last year, at least five attendees to a violent pro-Trump Patriot March in San Diego also attended a January 6th insurrection attempt. Just 3 days later, participants in the Patriot March conversely engaged in violent acts, seemingly without consequence, the appeal added. In the aftermath of the event, conspiracy charges were selectively leveled by San Diego prosecutors against alleged anti-fascists last December as well. Kira Knutson, president of Communication Workers of America Local 7250, offered his perspective on the analysis. My initial reaction is that this is a very superficial understanding of political forces, like someone who doesn't know much probably got paid a lot of money to play on Google for a few hours. There's no Antifa headquarters. There's not even a Torch headquarters. The Minneapolis Police Department presentation wrongly claims Antifa entered the modern scene at the Unite the Right rally in Charleston. Or Charlottesville, rather. Charlottesville, Virginia. The presentation failed to mention the white supremacist terror attack on anti-racist counter-demonstrations that killed Heather Heyer and injured 35 others. This is of import as the neo-Nazis who attacked the counter-demonstration was driving a car when he plowed into the crowd, a tactic that would become increasingly prominent both locally in Minneapolis but also nationally. Yeah, they're just making up crap about Antifa to vilify Antifa. So what is it? Are the Minneapolis Police Department just complete stupid idiots that don't know what they're talking about? Or was this by purposeful design to go after political enemies in town? We'll talk more about it tomorrow. Have a good one. We're back on a Wednesday. Till then, see ya.